Lab Tech Unplugged, unearthing topics in the life sciences.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Lab Tech Unplugged. I'm your host, Rachel, and in today's episode of our Spotlight on Sustainable Science series, I'm joined by SPT Lab Tech Melissa Netwall and Jonathan Faherty, and we'll be exploring the impact of non-contact dispensing on environmental footprint in labs. Melissa is on our field application science team on the West Coast, where she supports our liquid handling community there. And building on an academic background in molecular biology, Melissa's career in the life sciences has focused on high throughput strain and enzyme engineering, followed by a decade in automated liquid handling. So thank you, Melissa, and hello.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. And we're also joined by Jonathan, our drug discovery product manager, who drives the development of instruments in our liquid handling portfolio. Where, with an academic background in biochemistry, Jonathan has since spent his career in the scientific instruments industry in both technical sales and supporting user adoption in field application roles. So welcome, Jonathan. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So how are you both doing today?
All right. Can't complain.
Lovely. I mean, I'm great. It is way too early. But I'm... I'm sure people don't generally need to warn you about this because you would think about it. When you join a company based in the UK, you don't think about the fact that you're going to have to get up at 6 a.m. for 7 a.m. meetings sometimes.
You have been very generous and joined us at quite an unsociable hour, so thank you. Before we kick off the conversation in this episode, can you both just tell us a bit about your backgrounds and when you first became aware of sustainability as an issue in the lab? Melissa, as you've joined us so early, let's start with you.
Oh, thank you. Like most scientists who kind of end up in the synthetic biology field, really took an interest in undergrad. I thought I wanted to be an environmental scientist, work for the DNR, maybe, and spend my days outside. And as I learned more and more about sustainability and how we address the problems that we face as a species and society, it became more and more clear that the type of work that has the potential to make a really huge impact is replacing petroleum synthesis of products with sustainable ecological, biotechnological solutions. And then I got into industry and I worked in a very high throughput setting. We were doing strain engineering of some novel hosts to produce products via fermentation rather than using petroleum-based methods. And at the end of the day, you were just surrounded in a mountain of tip boxes. And as fun as it was to, make art out of all of the hundreds of tip boxes that we had at the end of the day, it also kind of sends you into a doom spiral of like, is anything that I'm doing actually matter? Does this cancel everything out? The sciences use an incredible amount of plastic. And so being able to reduce that in whatever way is possible is really, really kind of where I first jumped into it. First got involved and really passionate about sustainability in the life sciences. I was very rambly, but here we are.
No, I don't think so at all. I don't think I'm going to be able to be as thorough with my answer, to be honest.
Is that because I took up so much time?
No, you covered too much there. There's nothing left for me. I think it's one of those things because my background is similar in that, I started off at the bench and same as Melissa, you see a huge amount of plastic being generated by the work you're doing. I think for me, kind of, it was almost a feeling of it being a necessary evil. I think I never really took on board sustainability until a little bit further into my career because it felt like we're doing important work. This is all necessary in order to be able to do the research we're doing. I think part of what has kind of changed my mind is seeing these alternative options emerging. But I think that's for everything when it comes to sustainability, right? We've all been set in our ways and thinking this is the way to do things. We don't really have other options. Reality is we have to go out and find those options. We have to put effort in to create those options because, you know, we need to do the right thing here. We don't really have a choice as a species other than to invest more in sustainability. So it's that kind of change in thinking, I think, was the big thing for me of going, well, you know, you have to do this. You have to find new ways.
Yeah, that's certainly something that's come up in the podcast before, that just because we're in the industry of research and development doesn't mean we're immune from, just because, you know, as a we're doing good and we're having a net positive effect on the world, it doesn't mean that we're immune from trying to reduce our environmental impact. And as Melissa said, a huge part of that is single-use plastics and consumables. This has come up time and time again as we've spoken to different people in the industry. So with that being said, what's your awareness and experience of alternative techniques, approaches to these single-use plastics and avoiding these absolute mountains of Pipette boxes?
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a few different ways of going about that. I mean, I think perhaps the one that seems simplest or most obvious is reusing, washing tips and then reusing them again. And while on the surface, it seems like a fairly simple solution to the problem, there's lots of cases where that is not really ideal. So in a lot of the work that we do, contamination is a really big issue. And it's something you really have to avoid. And once you introduce the idea of washing or reusing these tips, you increase that risk quite significantly. And the idea that, okay, maybe we're saving this much plastic by doing this, but if we get a contamination and then we lose a huge amount of work because of that, then you need to start from scratch. And suddenly you're doing everything again. And in that respect, you know, you're putting all of that plastic or whatever else resources you might be using again on top of what you've already used. And potentially at that point, you might have to step back from that idea of reusing tips. So while in some cases it can be a solution, there are other cases where it's not a one size fits all, is what I would say.
I was just going to say, there's like also spaces where it's just, you can't, for safety reasons, reutilize tips, like particularly in like human therapeutics, clinical trials, like you just
absolutely
can't reuse tips. I think, what is the company? Grenova? Like, I think it's amazing what they've done. And I think that there is a very niche market where that is totally applicable. But kind of going back to what Jonathan was saying, like, it takes, like in a genomics core, it takes one rogue piece of DNA. And as we've all learned, DNA is an incredibly robust molecule to take down an entire experiment. And so, like, it's sometimes just not worth the risk to rewash tips to then use them again, as sad as that is.
Yeah, it's a shame because it seems the most straightforward way. You could also maybe tackle it from the other direction. So instead of being, okay, I've done my experiment, now I have all these tips, what do I do with that? You can also go back to the beginning and use something like, well, design of experiment is a good example, where you're doing your kind of preparation up front so that you're designing your experiments in such a way that you get to your final assay with a minimal amount of time and consumables spent. So that's kind of that idea of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So putting in that effort up front, you know, really putting in the preparation so that you're minimizing the wastage along the way. Again, that's not necessarily something that's going to, you know, cut your plastic use down to nothing, but it does mean that what you are using, you're doing in maybe the most efficient way that you can.
Yeah. And the analysis is really fun too.
Yes. Depends on the person, whether or not they consider it fun, but yeah, absolutely. I know a lot of the guys at Synthase would agree with you on that one. And then I think maybe the one that we're probably most familiar with is non-contact dispensing.
Yeah, no, that leads very well. As you mentioned, our friends at Synthase, who work a lot with our non-contact dispensing technology and with Dragonfly. So for any of our For any of our listeners who aren't familiar with Dragonfly and its technology, can you tell us a bit more about it and what it means for researchers who are performing liquid handling tests in the lab?
Yeah, sure. So Dragonfly is a non-contact dispenser. So rather than utilizing a full array of 96 or 384 well tips, you can dispense your reagent across a 96, 384, 1536 plate using a single syringe or a few different syringes. The Dragonfly has anywhere between 3, 6, and 10 independent heads. And the big component there that I like to push with scientists is there's two of them. One is the reduction in plastic waste, which I will circle back to. But the other is that it is based on true positive displacement. So for anyone who's ever worked with a pipette, like even a single channel pipette, you know that different liquid classes require different pipetting techniques. This is true when you scale that up to a full automated system, either a 384 wellhead or a 96 wellhead. And liquid class optimization for air displacement is can be a little tricky. But that is because air is the force that is moving your liquid. Whereas the Dragonfly technology, or the true positive displacement that we have in place, is rather than air being the force that's moving your liquid, it's in direct contact with the plunger inside of the syringe. And so what we like to say is that is liquid class agnostic. Anywhere from 70% ethanol to 70% glycerol, you can dispense, you can aspirate and dispense with default settings. It is very rare that we have to tinker with anything. So that's one huge benefit of it. But the reason that we're here is to talk about sustainability. Just the sole virtue of utilizing a single syringe rather than a full array of tips kind of spills over into those plastic savings. But
you both work very closely with adopters of liquid handling technology, whether that's labs in academia, pharma, CROs, across the board. I know you both work very closely with that community. So from what you've seen and your personal experiences when working with labs, what impact has non-contact dispensing had? How has it changed things for them? We'd be interested to know personal anecdotes.
I can think of two that jump to mind for me, and because they're kind of two different use cases as well. One is kind of going back to the topic we mentioned earlier, design of experiment, because that was one particular application where we're using both DOE and non-contact dispensing. The useful thing there is, you know, you've kind of got a multiplicative effect of having two different techniques for reducing plastic usage. Oftentimes when you're doing design of experiment, you're working with pretty complex assays. You know, you could have, well, working with a Dragonfly with 10 heads, you could have 10 components in a single well, and then they're going to vary across that entire plate. So if you think about the idea of using, you know, a standard air displacement pipetting system where you're changing the tips, the amount of tips you go through can be absolutely massive. So in that particular example, I think we used 20 syringes on the Dragonfly Discovery. And to do the same thing with 384 tips, you get through about 60 boxes. So the idea of, you know, 20 syringes about yay size, although we are being recorded, so you won't be able to see me doing that, but 20 syringes that are not particularly large versus 60 boxes of 384 tips, there's a huge difference in the amount of plastic there. And that's kind of thinking on one side of consumables, but we have another customer that I think is really interesting because they fill up to 800 plates a day with their Dragonfly system. So they are changing tips as they go along, but the idea of 800 plates being filled by what amounts to about a similar amount, 20 to 30 syringes in a day, if you think about doing the same thing with kind of classic air displacement tips, the sheer amount of plastic that you would use there. So those are two ones that stick out to me just because of that visual of what is essentially 20 syringes that could almost fit in one hand versus, you know, dumpsters full of plastic tips. It's a really clear idea.
Yeah. And I mean, that's just talking about one day. So then if you think days and weeks, plus years. Yeah, yeah. That is an image.
Absolutely.
What about you, Melissa?
Yeah, absolutely. This visual of the tip is yay high.
Yes.
So the syringe is, off the top of my head, the syringe weighs about 4 grams. An array of 96 well tips, not including the box that they come into, is like around 150 grams. And so if you scale that, like think about something really simple, like setting up a PCR twice a week, for instance, I don't know, 4 plates twice a week. You're going to save literally thousands of kilograms at the end of the year, just sole plastic use. And that's, again, not including the actual tip box itself, which don't even get me started on why tip boxes are the way that they are. Can we have, like, some non-plastic tip boxes for automation, please? Is that a thing that I can have someday in my lifetime? Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the most salient. Going back to what Jonathan was saying about dumpsters of tip boxes, like we used to do this thing in the lab that I worked in. We would, like, at the end of the day, like, go box in somebody's desk, like their entire desk, with a cult, like, just walls of tip boxes. Like, and as funny as that is, like, you think back on it and it's like borderline traumatizing how much stick we would go through in a single day. And so, yeah, just being able to scale that down by something, switching it to something as simple as non-contact dispensing can have an incredible impact. I always tell people, if I ever go back to the bench, I'm going to make somebody buy me a dragonfly or a firefly.
Well, I think, you know, the boxes are another example of that kind of inertia, right? These are the way things have been done, and they're continuing to be done that way. It is an industry that is, I guess, notorious for when something works, sticking with it, right? Science can be really complex. And when you get a workflow working, sometimes you just don't want to change anything. You just want to keep it locked down because it's working.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes that mindset might spread out to other aspects of what we're doing. And that can be a bit disadvantageous, right? I mean, we're scientists. We should be wanting to innovate. And I think when it comes to the ways that we can reduce our plastic usage, it's a good reason to innovate and try new things.
Yeah, definitely. Like, kind of in that same vein, it takes so much to change a process because of all the bureaucracy involved in it. But a lot of times, a consumer-driven push can change things. And so you're seeing a lot more of, like, consumers or customers asking for sustainable solutions. Like My Green Labs, for instance, they offer a certification, and there are some companies that won't even touch you if you don't have a certification like the one that they offer. So hopefully that starts to push things forward.
And the power of that is massive. It's easy to underestimate that, but a lot of places, they won't change unless there's some level of external pressure to change. And that's something we're seeing in the industry, that from various different sources, there is more and more of a pressure towards being more sustainable. And those are the things that are driving the change. And that, I think, is very much grassroots in a lot of places. So it's not a case of it necessarily, the CEO walking in and deciding, right, we're being sustainable now. Because they have people working in those businesses who are saying, hey, we really need to think about sustainability. And there's enough people going, yeah, we really do, that it's building that consensus. So, those individual voices are actually really important, I think, in that process of getting that pressure applied and really pushing to change those processes. So, again, it's that idea of a network of pressure. It's not just coming from one direction. It's not just one person making a decision. It's, there's government entities that are putting pressure on. There's individual people within companies that are putting pressure on. It's coming from every side, which is a good thing. And I'm glad to see it. And especially when you look at, like, some of the biggest companies for putting that pressure on that I've seen have been pharma companies. And because for suppliers, they're such a huge, huge market, we have to accommodate them. And that's great that they're putting that pressure on. But again, that's probably because they're getting pressure from the government, and they're getting pressure from their customers and their employees, and it's a big network effect. I think
this is probably more of an existential question, but who can put pressure on big pharma? It can't be consumers. Who is it?
Well, I think honestly, it's a cumulative effect, right? Because I think within those organizations, it's probably the people who are working there. You get enough people mm-hmm. together saying, hey, we should be more sustainable and forming yeah. a group within that organization. But then also, if you have governments that are pushing to net zero and saying, hey, there are subsidies available, you know, there are tax breaks available mm-hmm. for those companies that are willing to do it. I mean, when you're talking about pharma profit margins, if they're saying, hey, we're going to get taxed 0.5% less, it's probably a significant amount of money in that. So,
yeah. That's a good point.
But then why do governments do it? Because they're getting pressure from their voters. So it isn't just someone else will do it. We all have to do it within our organizations and even within our governments, I guess.
That kind of sums up nicely what this series has been about, that it's not one, there's not as one solution fits all, and it's not just coming from one voice. It's this, as you said, this network thing, this community push. Everyone is becoming more aware of the issues, realizing that something needs to be done. And what's been nice in this series is that we've looked at different approaches to it, whether that's innovations in technology or whether that's bringing in certifications, trying to get buying to drive a wider change. There's these separate things are working kind of in symphony to hopefully bring about bigger changes. So that fits in quite nicely really with what we've seen in this. So one thing that we have been doing throughout this series is, before we wrap up each episode, it's just thinking if there is one takeaway for each of our listeners to take home from today's discussion, what would that be? So I will ask that question to the two of you. Jonathan?
Who wants to go first? Me? Okay.
Yeah.
I guess the takeaway for me is that, you know, I think we can't necessarily change things overnight. We can't go to net zero instantly. You know, we're always going to have some level of plastic usage within our industry. I think the goal we need to have right now is do what's within our power to start going in the right direction. So to make those steps that, will ideally in the long term get us to where we want to be, and not letting perfect be the enemy of good. So, you know, going out and having a think about, okay, is there a way with this workflow that I'm using that I can shave down some of this plastic, that I can be more sustainable? And, you know, maybe it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get to 50% reduction, but if you can reduce by 5%, 10%, if you can go to your organization and ask them if there's anything they can do to help the overall sustainability of the work that you're doing, then go and do that, and don't necessarily say, okay, you know, it's not something we can solve overnight, so why bother?
Yeah.
Lovely. Thank you.
Totally agree with you. And kind of going back to something you were saying earlier, like, it's a compounding effect, right? In order to make a change, it has to come from multiple different directions. And so one thing that I would take away from today, or that I've taken away from my 10 years of kind of screaming into the abyss at different organizations that I've worked at, is don't let anyone tell you that it's not your job to work on these types of initiatives. It really does take an incredible amount of community and organizing and pushing, either internally or externally, to other companies to move these types of things forward. And so, you know, regardless of how small the thing that you are is doing, or how small you might think it is making an impact. And so just continuing to push and hope, doing a little bit more than hoping, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you both for joining us today. I hope listeners have found this entertaining and insightful. What was a discussion that started off around non-contact dispensing has gone a lot broader, which I think is fantastic. And it just shows the level of enthusiasm on a topic like this. So if you have any ideas or comments or questions from what you've heard today, or even if you'd like to join us for a future episode, then you can always reach out to us at community@sptlabtech.com. We've got plenty more episodes on the way, so make sure that you're subscribed to catch them as they're released. And so lastly, thank you once again, Melissa and Jonathan, for joining us today. It's been lovely to have you. And we'll see you all again soon.
Thank you, Rachel. This has been really great.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Goodbye.